mean?" I asked. "It's the intensive care unit," she said. "It's where patients go when they are very sick. The patients who need to be monitored very closely. He isn't doing well. I think that you guys should get some rest today and go see him tomorrow." Early the next morning, our mom called Bristol Hospital and asked if they could transfer our dad to Hartford Hospital, where she thought he could receive advanced treatment. "He's not doing well," the nurse said. "You should come to the hospital as soon as you can." In the hallway outside our dad's room, we put on latex gloves, a yellow gown, and a white mask to cover our faces. We entered, and I used my right hand to slide the curtain to the side. There was an IV bag dripping fluid into his left arm and a ventilator tube coming out of his mouth, which kept him breathing. I leaned in close to his ear and told him to hang in there, to keep fighting. I told him I was so proud of the changes he had made in his life to become the best father I ever could have wished for. My mother was on the other side of the bed, rubbing his arm. Aaron stood behind her, paralyzed. After about an hour of staring at his closed eyelids, the doctor recommended that we return home to get some rest. He said there was nothing we could do at this time, and he would contact us later with an update. We returned to the house, but just as Aaron and I placed our heads down on our pillows, our mother opened the door to our room. "TJ, Aaron, get up now," she screamed. "We have to get back to the hospital now." Gripping the steering wheel so hard that the veins in her hands bulged, my mother drove like lightning for 5 minutes back to Bristol Hospital. Aaron, in the back seat, started to sob. Then we all did. When we reached the waiting room outside the ICU, a dozen family members had already gathered. A few were kneeling together, circled in prayer. Others were on their feet, crying. Our dad's sister sat in her wheelchair with her face in her hands, yelling, "He's not going to make it! He's not going to make it!" We continued past them to my father's room. I threw the curtains off to the side in time to see the doctor yell, "Clear!" as he held the two defibrillator paddles to our dad's chest. The three of us stood with our hands clasped, 5 feet in front of the footboard, watching helplessly, in horror. The doctor again pressed the paddles on our dad, causing his chest to jump and his legs and toes to kick toward us. "Clear!" They shocked him again. "Clear!" They shocked him again. Aaron squeezed my left hand tighter. "Please, DJ. Please, DJ, help him." I felt my mom begin to fall. I grabbed both of them harder. "Everything is going to be okay," I said to them. "Keep fighting, Dad," I shouted to my father. "Keep fighting." "Come on, Dad," Aaron yelled. The doctor paused, the paddles held up in midair. There was no response. Only the steady beep from the heart monitor. Flatline. Time of death, 12:05 p.m. January 6th, 2006. He was 49 years old. The three of us walked forward to our leader. I put my left ear on his chest, hoping to hear one more beat. Aaron's head rested on the other side of his belly. Our tears pooled in his belly button. Our mother kissed him on his forehead and rubbed his thick black hair. After about 20 minutes, I finally let go. I softly told Aaron that when he was ready, we needed to leave. Aaron kept his arms around our dad, unwilling to move. I hugged Aaron. He didn't want to let go. "It's time," I whispered. After several minutes, Aaron released his grasp. That night, after family and friends had left our house, Aaron and I went to our room. In the dark, we whispered to each other from our beds about never hearing Dad's voice again. I slid into Aaron's bed. I held my cell phone between us, and we listened to our dad's voicemail greeting over and over and over. Chapter 7. January 2006. The line stretched out the door of the funeral home, onto and around the spacious front porch, through the parking lot, and up Lincoln Avenue for a quarter of a mile. The director estimated that more than 1,000 people came to our father's visitation on January 8th. My mother, Aaron, and I stood next to the dark wooden casket, waiting to greet everyone after they said their final goodbyes to Dennis Hernandez. I was in a black suit and one of my father's favorite black and yellow ties. To my right, my mother, in a long black dress and sweater, wept during the four-hour wake. "He's at peace now. He's at peace now," she repeatedly said. To my left was Aaron, outfitted in a gray pinstripe suit, the first suit he'd ever worn. Our dad never had the chance to teach him how to tie a tie, so that morning I assisted Aaron, putting another one of our father's ties into a single Windsor for him. All afternoon, Aaron stood still and silent, looking straight ahead, as if his eyes were locked onto something far in the distance, past everyone in the room, past the walls of the chapel in the funeral home. He never cried. Once the room was empty, I shut the doors so the four of us could be together one last time. Aaron and I took a knee in the pew in front of the open casket, holding hands. Our mother stood behind us, caressing our shoulders. After several minutes, my mother and I kissed my father on the forehead. Aaron couldn't bear the sight of our father. Aaron tapped him on his hands and looked away so he wouldn't see his face. That night, the three of us slept together in my parents' bed. My father used two pillows. Aaron and I each buried our heads into one of them, trying to hold on to his scent. Several times during the night, our mother ran to the bathroom to vomit. After the first time, we followed her in, rubbing her back and holding her hair as she knelt over the bowl. The funeral service was the next morning at St. Joseph's Church in Bristol. The three of us sat in the front wooden pew. Aaron's chest was out, his shoulders back, and his eyes focused forward, rarely moving right or left. Holding my left hand, he felt the jerk from my body when I cried, which caused him to squeeze my hand tighter. Midway through the funeral, my mother leaned in to us and asked us if we wanted to say any words about our father. Aaron closed his eyes and shook his head. I whispered, "I can't, Mom. There's no way I can talk right now." Once the service concluded, we stood up from the pew and wiggled our legs to loosen up. We didn't know what to do next. The funeral director waved to us, and we followed our mom down the center aisle, outside to a black town car waiting for us at the curb. I looked out the back window as we began the drive to the cemetery, and saw a long trail of cars in the procession, their hazard lights all flashing. A police cruiser led the way. At the grave site, we took our seats about 8 feet from where the casket would soon be lowered. As soon as the short ceremony began, I grabbed Aaron's thigh to let him know I was there for him. I eventually lifted my eyes from my lap and saw mourners piling flowers on the casket. The three of us waited in our chairs, shivering in the cold, for every last person to lay their rose. Then we slowly placed our own roses onto the casket before returning to our car. A large group gathered at Nucci's, a local restaurant, to celebrate our father. I didn't understand why people were laughing as they shared stories over lunch. Only 1 hour earlier, we had left our father to be buried into the frozen ground. I turned to my mom and whispered, "Why are they talking?" "People are telling good stories about your dad," my mom said softly. "They're sharing stories about the amazing man he was." "The good days with him were so exciting," she told me in the days after his death. "He was so nice. He was funny. He was beautiful. He was a great dancer, and he made me feel special. He also was a big football star. He had a great smile and muscles. He became a great father. There was so much about the man I loved." But she also hated him at times. "On our wedding night, I caught your dad going to the bathroom and snorting cocaine," she said. "We got into a fight, and your father ripped off my wedding ring, picked up a hammer and smashed it, bending the ring and dislodging the diamonds. The next morning he apologized. 'It won't happen again,' he told me." She had held in a lot. There were two sides to your father. When he was clean of drugs, and when he wasn't, she said. The night after Aaron was born, your father didn't even show up at the hospital. He was so fucked up, he left you with someone and went out to party. He wasn't there for Aaron and me that night. I went through a lot of shit with him, and I'm sorry because I took it out on you kids. I look back now and think, how the hell did we ever survive that shit? In the car, my mother asked Aaron if he wanted to play in his high school basketball game that evening. What do you think Dad would have wanted me to do? Aaron asked. He would have said, keep moving forward, my mom said. I agreed. But who will I hand the ball to if I score my 1,000th point tonight? It was supposed to be Dad. When we got home, Aaron called our Uncle David, our father's twin brother, who was battling liver cancer but was able to attend the funeral. Aaron asked him if he would come to the game and accept the ball. I wouldn't miss it for the world, Uncle David said. A few hours later, my mother and I entered the front glass doors at Bristol Central. As we were walking through the hallways, one person after the next approached and offered condolences, almost like another receiving line leading into the gymnasium. When we entered, the crowd fell silent. Suddenly, the only sounds were the bouncing of the balls and squeaks of the players' shoes during warm-ups. We felt every set of eyes turned to us. I spotted Aaron dribbling a basketball in the hallway outside the locker room, preparing to enter the gym for pregame warm-ups. I went to him, wished him good luck, and asked how he was feeling. I'm doing all right, Dee, he said. Returning to my seat, I thought how different this night was going to be from when I had scored my 1,000th point 3 years earlier, when I'd handed my milestone ball to my father. If he had been here tonight, he would be sitting next to me chewing on his right thumb, commenting on the game and Aaron's play. He would have been the happiest guy in the gym. Before tip-off, the public address announcer asked everyone to stand and remove their hats for a moment of silence for our father. I didn't want to close my eyes because they had been shut from crying for most of the last 2 days. From the bleachers, I looked at my brother, six rows down on the wooden court. His eyes were closed. His hands were clasped behind his back, and he was gently swaying left to right. Minutes into the game, Aaron had the ball on a fast break. He soared into the air for a rim-rattling dunk. The packed gym erupted. A few possessions later, Aaron slashed to the basket for a right-handed layup, his 1,000th career point. The scorekeeper buzzed the horn as the ball dropped through the net. The officials whistled to stop the game and asked Aaron to come to midcourt, where they acknowledged his accomplishment and presented him with the ball. Receiving a standing ovation, Aaron jogged up into the bleachers toward our uncle and handed him the ball before the action resumed. A few days later, preparing to drive back to college to begin my spring semester, I talked to Aaron. If you need anything, I'm only 45 minutes away, I said. Dad would have wanted you to remain focused and keep working hard. Mom might need your help more around the house. After basketball season is over, maybe we can plan something, and you can come spend time with me. That would be amazing, Dee, he said. Aaron sat on the front steps, watching me drive away. Chapter 8. February, 2006. The second week of February, I returned to Bristol for my father's birthday. On the way, I stopped at Family Dollar and bought his favorite candy, Red Hot Dollars. I planned to leave the box on his headstone. I asked Aaron to come with me to the cemetery, but he insisted on staying home. I'm not ready, Dee, he said. I'm not going until I win a Super Bowl. It was too early to press him, so I went to the burial site by myself. Standing on the hardened dirt, I bent down, wished my father a happy 50th, and placed his candy next to a birthday card my mother had left the day before. The headstone wasn't in place yet. Before going back to my dorm the next day, Aaron caught me off guard with a question as I was exiting the house. Dee, Do you think I'm good enough to play somewhere besides UConn? He asked. You're good enough to play wherever you want. You being committed to UConn is a huge deal for our program, and everyone is excited about you coming. You're going to dominate when you get to campus. I can't wait to play with you again. 2 months later, I received a phone call from Aaron. I don't want you to be upset, he said, but I am going to visit the University of Florida. Have you told Coach Edsel yet? No, he said. You need to tell him before you go, I said. Dad would be pissed at you if you visited Florida behind Coach Edsel's back, and you know that. Please don't say anything, Dee, he said. Aaron, it's not my place to say anything, but you need to tell him, I said. And do not commit to Florida during your trip. Wait until you're home so we can discuss everything. I hung up the phone and called my mother. What's going on with Aaron? I asked. He's visiting Florida? He's excited about going, she said. I called one of his old youth coaches and asked him to go on the trip with him. I need a man's perspective now that your dad is not here. He knows more about football and recruiting than I do. A week later, Aaron and his youth coach Tom Wagman flew to Gainesville for Aaron's unofficial visit. We were sitting on the plane, and we made a pros and cons list on a sheet of paper to compare all the colleges that were recruiting Aaron, Tom told me. I looked over at Aaron and said, "Do not make your decision until we return home." I reminded him that he was committed to UConn. Before we got off the plane, I said it again. Aaron and Tom drove to the Gators football facility, where they spotted hundreds of Winnebagos parked in the lots in anticipation of the spring game the following day. Fans covered in orange and blue gear walked near the stadium. They were greeted by two assistant coaches and taken to watch practice. Hundreds ringed the practice field. The atmosphere was electric, Tom said. Afterward, the coaches took them to Ben Hill Griffin Stadium, the Gators' home field, known as the Swamp. Once they arrived at the Gator Walk, the coaches described how on game day, when the bus doors open, thousands of fans line the brick walkway to cheer and snap photos of the players as they descend from the buses, the fans reaching over the ropes to slap the players' hands. Aaron stepped out of the tunnel and looked at the steep bleachers and at the orange walls as music blared from the speakers. It was the biggest stadium Aaron had ever entered, and he couldn't stop smiling. He bent down and skimmed his hands over the short-cut grass field. "Is this really grass?" Aaron asked, accustomed to the turf we played on in high school. The Florida coaches laughed and confirmed that the grass was real. After touring the facilities, Aaron met with quarterback Tim Tebow, who told Aaron how excited he was that Aaron was considering Florida. Aaron immediately liked him. Aaron wanted to be wearing the school colors for the game, so the next morning, Tom took him shopping for a pair of blue shoes. He wanted to look like he was a part of the team. Aaron watched the game from the sideline. Afterward, he met the entire Gator coaching staff in the football facility. The coaches were sitting around a long table, and Aaron took a seat with them. "Well, how did you like that?" Urban Meyer, the head coach, asked. Aaron stood up from his seat and blurted out, "I am coming here." The Florida coaches high-fived each other and hugged Aaron. But Aaron's youth coach, Tom, was shocked. "No, no, no," he said. "Urban, it's not happening like this. Aaron has to make two phone calls right now. The minute we leave here, it's going to be on the internet and everywhere. He has to call his mom, and he has to call Randy Edsel at UConn." My phone started to ring as I was driving back from Hanover, New Hampshire, where I had watched the Dartmouth College spring game. "Hey, Dee," Aaron said. "I just want you to know that I committed to Florida." "Did you tell Coach Edsel?" "No," he said. "What did I tell you, Aaron?" I said, raising my voice. "You're a fucking idiot. I can't believe you did this, Aaron." Just then, my flip phone began vibrating and ringing. I looked at who was calling. Coach Edsel. I ignored the incoming call and remained on the line with Aaron. Edsel phoned a second time. "Edsel is blowing up my phone right now," I said. "You need to call him, Aaron." "What should I say to him?" "That's your problem now," I said. Coach Edsel called a third time. I was finished speaking with Aaron, so I answered.
DJ, what is going on with Aaron? Edsel said, his voice frantic. What the hell is going on?
Coach, I said, I'm still trying to figure this all out myself. I was pissed. I didn't care that Aaron wanted to check out Florida. I was disappointed with how quickly everything transpired, considering the limited amount of information he had gathered. He could have gone to virtually any top program in the country, and I wanted him to put some thought into his decision.
In Florida, Aaron paced nervously as he dialed Edsel's number.
Edsel answered the phone, and Aaron informed him of his decision.
Edsel chewed him a new ass up and down, the youth coach said. Aaron took the phone and held it away from his ear because Edsel was screaming so loud.
Then Aaron called our mother.
Mom, I like it here, he said. I committed to Florida, and I'm happy about that. But I'm also upset because it seems like I let Coach Edsel down.
Aaron handed the phone to Coach Meyer, who spoke to my mother for a few minutes, assuring her that Aaron would be in good hands. After leaving the facility, Aaron and his youth coach went to celebrate by getting ice cream. As Aaron dug for his second spoonful, a fan approached.
You're Aaron Hernandez, the fan said. You just committed here.
On the way back to the hotel, several local reporters called Aaron's cell phone, asking for a comment. A few other reporters showed up at the hotel, where they interviewed Aaron outside the lobby. Once the media left, Aaron relaxed in his room.
This is the best place for me, Aaron said to his youth coach. It's where I have to go to get to the NFL, and I'll have a chance to win a national championship here.
When they returned to Connecticut a few days later, Aaron changed his mind.
I think I want to go to UConn, Aaron told his youth coach.
I will back you on whatever you want to do, the youth coach said. You think about everything that happened. You think about it.
Aaron wavered again. He was going to Florida.
I returned to UConn, feeling like I had done something wrong. I went to Coach Edsel's office to speak with him. I didn't want this to fester.
I'm so sorry, Coach, I said. I hope my brother's decision doesn't affect me in any way.
You had nothing to do with this, he said. It's not your fault. I'm just blown away by his decision. Aaron doesn't know much about Florida. I can't believe he didn't talk to me first.
I know, Coach, I said, shaking my head.
Neither can I.
Chapter 9. July 2006. That summer, I stayed at UConn, working out with the team. I called home a few times a week, checking in on my mom and Aaron. But even that was hard, because the phone calls triggered memories of my dad. He had always answered when he was home, often picking up halfway through the first ring. With Dad no longer present, my mom now answered the phone, and she always sounded tired, like she hadn't slept in days. One July weekend, I went home to visit. I noticed a change in the house as soon as I opened the side door. I knew that Aaron didn't have a game, and my mother had finished work for the day, but no one was in the kitchen, and the lights were off. I walked across the worn green rug into the living room. The television was off, and the sectional couch looked as if it hadn't been touched in months. The throw pillows had no bodyweight imprints on them, and the remotes were side by side on the ottoman. I went to my childhood bedroom. I turned on the light. The blue blinds were pulled down to the window ledge above my old bed. Wrinkled clothes were stacked up on the ironing board. In the old days, Aaron would sometimes jump out from around a corner and yell, "Ah!" to surprise me. Today, no one was there. I opened the old wooden doors to my father's side of the closet. His clothes were still there, untouched since the day he died. I grabbed the right sleeve to his beloved maroon fleece and lifted it to my nose. His scent was lost, overtaken by the constant smoke coming from my mother's burning cigarette. I walked into my parents' room. It was dark. The bed wasn't made.
and the 19-inch TV cast its glow over my mom, lying on her side under the covers. It was the middle of the afternoon, and she was sound asleep. Her black nightstand was covered with balled tissues, and the ashtray, which she always dumped out, overflowed with a mound of crushed cigarette butts. I gave her a kiss on her head before she woke up and let out a slow, "Hey." She turned on her bedside lamp and stood up. I was startled. "Mom, are you okay?" I asked. "You look exhausted. You are so skinny. Are you eating?"
"Dee, I've lost 35 pounds, she said. "I'm down to 100.
Her pants didn't fit, and her neck was thinner.
"It's like I have a nervous energy constantly traveling through my body," she said. "I can't make it stop."
The first few months after my father's passing, I, too, had trouble eating. My weight had dropped from 212 pounds to 182. I vomited often. Almost every time I put food near my mouth, I experienced a gagging sensation. For breakfast, I'd go to the dining hall and try to keep down a banana. But now, 5 months after the funeral, my appetite had returned, and my weight was back up to 205.
"I'm so sorry, Mom," I said.
"Do you know where Aaron is?"
"He's either working out or over at Tanya's," she said.
Growing up, my father's older sister Ruthie and her daughter Tanya used to babysit us back when we were still in diapers. I remember sitting under the kitchen table next to my aunt's leg as 3 Rottweilers roamed around the kitchen floor. They terrified us. Every now and then my aunt would drop one of her bingo markers on the ground and Aaron and I would stamp each other with it. As Aaron grew older, his relationship with Tanya strengthened. Aunt Ruthie and Tanya would welcome anyone with a pulse into their house, drug dealers, drug users, even convicted felons. At times, our dad would stay there all night playing dominoes and drinking with the guys. Aaron and I would be at the kitchen table playing board games with our cousins and aunts until our mother said it was time to leave. When our mother gave us the 10-minute warning, we would begin giving our family members at the table hugs and kisses before going downstairs to say goodbye to everyone else. Walking down the steps, we passed through clouds of smoke. "The boys and I are leaving in 5 minutes," she'd tell our dad. If he wanted to stay and finish his game, our mother would say, "Find a ride. We are leaving." On the car ride home, she would be pissed that he didn't come with us. "I fucking hate going over there," she told us. "In that house, there's no rules, no structure, and they let people do whatever the hell they want." The next morning, we would have a bowl of Fruity Pebbles for breakfast, and then make our way to the living room. My mother, Aaron, and I would be watching television, and our father would spend the entire day snoring in his bed.
"That son of a bitch," our mom would say. "I hate when he fucking goes over there."
Years later, it was at Tanya's where Aaron would be introduced to Ernest Beau Wallace. Aaron's daily routine continued as before. He seemed happy and rarely expressed any hurt, pain, or depression that he might have been experiencing.
My mother would ask him if he was okay, and he'd respond with one word.
"Yeah." Unlike our mom and me, he was gaining weight rather than losing it. Whenever I asked, "How are you doing?" he'd reply, "I'm fine, Dee," and change the subject. He was immersed in working out. One night, he was running hills with a weight vest on with one of his teammates. The other kid passed out from the exertion, and as Aaron carried him home, he told him, "I am going to be the best tight end in the NFL someday. You watch. I work harder than anyone else." When Aaron wasn't training, he would usually spend time with Tanya and Tanya's husband, Jeff, who in a short period had become Aaron's closest friend in Bristol. Jeff taught him how to drive and how to fish. Aaron asked me to join them one morning when I was home during my summer break. Right away, as we stood close together with our lines cast in a still pond deep in the woods, I noticed they had a great rapport. Their conversation was smooth and effortless. In September of Aaron's junior year, he made his official visit to Florida, Aaron invited his high school coach and Jeff to come along with my mother. One night, after Aaron had gone off with his host and several other Florida football players, my mother and Jeff explored campus together. They eventually stopped for pizza, then returned to the hotel with a six-pack of cold beer. They talked for hours. Back in Bristol, Jeff and my mother would cheer on Aaron at his basketball games. Both smokers, they often went outside together for a cigarette. Jeff asked my mother if she would be interested in grabbing drinks one night. A few nights later, they met in the school parking lot. As Jeff closed the passenger door to my mom's silver Nissan Juke, Tanya pulled up in front with her brights on. She jumped out of her car and began shouting at Jeff and my mom, accusing them of having an affair. My mom told Jeff he should get out of the car and go with Tanya. As Jeff stepped out, my mom said, "Tanya, we're not doing anything wrong." My mom drove off by herself. Tanya followed closely, flashing her high beams and honking her horn. My mother took a left into the gas station at the bottom of the hill. Tanya parked behind her and told Jeff to get out of the car. "You're fucking my husband," Tanya yelled to my mom. "I can't believe you're fucking my husband." "Tanya," my mom said, "we didn't do anything. We were going to have a drink." Tanya peeled off. Jeff got into my mom's car a second time, and she took him back to the school's parking lot to retrieve his white hoopty. They decided to go get a drink like they had planned. Tanya went home and immediately marched across the street to the youth football field, where Aaron was watching a practice. "Your mother is fucking my husband," she yelled loud enough for everyone in the crowd to hear. Aaron was stunned. That night, I was lying in my hotel bedroom in Bloomington, Indiana. The next afternoon, I would be making my fifth career start at quarterback against the Hoosiers. The room was dark, the TV was on, and my roommate, another quarterback, was napping in his bed on the other side of the room. My phone vibrated. I answered. "I can't take this anymore, D," Aaron said. "Calm down," I said. "Please tell me what's wrong." "Mom ruined our family," he said. "Aaron, where are you?" "I'm over Tanya's now," he said. "Let me call Mom and I'll call you right back." I dialed my mother's number. "Mom, how could you?" "Everything is being blown out of proportion, Dee," she said. "I didn't do anything wrong. I don't know why everyone is acting like this." I called Aaron back and told him I had to attend a team meeting. As I sat with the other quarterbacks, my mind wasn't on Indiana. All I could concentrate on was what was happening to my family in Bristol. After the meeting, I sat on a step in the hotel stairwell and phoned Aaron. He was crying and saying that our mother wasn't answering her cell phone anymore. It was getting close to bed check, so I returned to my room, still talking to Aaron. I was usually in bed asleep by now, but I didn't want to leave him alone like this. I buried my head under my pillow and whispered, not wanting to wake up my roommate. I fell asleep with Aaron on the other end of the phone. The next day, I played the worst game of my career. I was 5 of 13 for 27 yards, with two interceptions and lost a fumble going into the end zone. I was a sleeping quarterback, no energy. I was relieved we won, 14-7. The next day, back at UConn, I walked into the film room to review the game tape with my position group. Just before the projector bulb warmed up and shined out onto the white screen, Coach Edsel entered the room. "We have to play better at the quarterback position, and we need more consistency," he said. "We're going to make a change this upcoming week. DJ, you're going to be the backup." "Okay," I said. "It's a business. You have to do what you have to do." I was shocked that those words even came out of my mouth. It caught both Edsel and my quarterback coach by surprise. Edsel asked me if everything was okay. "Yep," I said. Before the Indiana game, being the starting quarterback for the Huskies was everything I had ever worked for. But over the next few weeks, Edsel could tell I wasn't focused because of my poor play from practice to practice. he finally asked me to come up to his office. As soon as I sat down in front of his desk, he rose from his chair and shut both of his office doors behind me. Right then, I knew this was going to be a serious conversation. "DJ, I need to know what's going on," he said. "You've been a leader for us, but I've noticed something hasn't been right for a while." He looked at me in silence, waiting for me to respond. I met his stare, saying nothing, shaking my head. I didn't want to open up about my family. I was ashamed of what my mother had done. I thought it made my entire family look bad. Finally, Edsel spoke again. "DJ, I don't want to do this, but if things don't change soon, we are going to move you down to the scout team, because we aren't getting anything out of you. If you don't let anyone in, no one can help you." Edsel sat there, patiently, waiting for me to say something, anything. "DJ," he said softly, "I'm here for you." "Coach, I lost my family," I said, with my voice cracking. "I have nothing. My father died, my brother's going to Florida, and my mother took my cousin's husband. My family will never be the same." Trying to keep it together, I explained to him that I hadn't spoken to my mother in months, since the night before the Indiana game. I told him how much I hated my life. Edsel got out of his leather chair and gave me a fatherly hug. He left the room for a minute and then returned with my position coach. "Anything you need, just tell us," Edsel said. "We'll always be here for you." I walked out of his office ready to move forward. I felt like I had a family again, my football family. It was worse for Aaron. 4 days after the Indiana game, our grandmother had told Aaron, who was staying with Tanya, to call our mother. "Aaron, I didn't do anything wrong," my mother said, referring to her night out with Jeff. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt you." Tanya had started telling Aaron that our mother and Jeff had likely been seeing each other when our father was alive. Tanya wouldn't even let Aaron say my mother's name. Jeff would soon move out of Tanya's house. "It was like Aaron was being brainwashed to hate me," my mother told me later. "There was no truth to what Tanya was telling him. I was sick of their shit and the things they were allowing him to do over there." My mom finally called Tanya. "A bartender just called me at work telling me you brought my 16-year-old son into their bar and slipped him drinks," she said. "It stops now." Tanya replied, "I'm his mother now," and hung up. Their tension grew as time passed. In November, Jeff moved out of Tanya's house. In December, my mother sat Aaron down and explained that she was going to start dating Jeff. After losing our dad, Aaron now felt like he had lost everything. Me to college, our father to death, and now our mother to Jeff. Chapter 10. October, 2006. On October 21st, Bristol Central played Maloney High School at Muzzy Field. I returned to watch Aaron play for the first time during his senior season. With less than 2 minutes remaining in the fourth quarter, Bristol trailed, 27-26. I couldn't take my eyes off my brother as the offense moved down the field. On the next snap, Aaron fired out of his three-point stance to engage in a block. His helmet collided with a linebacker's helmet. Aaron's body went limp, falling to the ground. First his butt, then his back, and then the back of his maroon helmet. His body remained motionless as trainers and coaches ran out onto the field to gather around him. I looked up to the top of the press box, where Bristol's offense coordinator sat, asking for an update. He shook his head, because he didn't have one yet. Finally, the trainer guided Aaron upright before Aaron took his helmet off. When Aaron got to his feet, the crowd clapped. The trainer and his head coach helped him off the field. I saw Aaron smile as he walked and talked, but then his body language shifted when his coach said, "Aaron, You are done for the night.
I'm fine, Coach, Aaron said. I'm ready to go back in.
I could tell something was wrong, so I ran out of the stands to ask Aaron if he was okay. He said his coach wouldn't let him play anymore.
I need to be out there, Aaron told me. I need to be out there with my team.
Calm down, I said. You don't need to be out there right now.
I'm fine. I have to be in there, he stated. My team needs me.
Determined to re-enter the game, Aaron started going up to his teammates and asking if he could borrow a helmet.
Let me wear your helmet, he said to each in turn.
I was confused. I looked back to the top of the press box and asked my all-defensive coordinator if Aaron was going to return to play.
No, he said. Your brother was knocked out cold. He's done.
Aaron remained sidelined for the rest of the game as he watched his team lose. He felt like he let his teammates down. My mother drove Aaron to the hospital, where doctors confirmed he had a concussion. After the exam, Aaron told our mom to take him to Tanya's.
There was no telling Aaron the word no, she told me. Aaron no longer had respect for me. He was done listening to me.
At the close of the season, Aaron was invited to play in the U.S. Army All-American Bowl in San Antonio, Texas. Aaron had finished his high school career with 3,677 receiving yards and 47 touchdowns, both state records. And his 180.7 receiving yards per game over his high school career was a national record. He was a two-time All-American and a two-time State Player of the Year. My entire family met Aaron in San Antonio. This was the first time I witnessed how much hatred Aaron had developed for our mother. I could tell he was still seething from her decision to be with Jeff. After the game, Aaron walked over to the stands and was nice to everyone, but he wouldn't acknowledge our mother. When she approached him, he said, "I don't talk to sluts or whores." We flew from San Antonio to Gainesville, Florida, to move Aaron into his college dorm. He had graduated from high school a semester early, so he could participate in spring football practice with the Gators. In our hotel room, we watched Florida beat Ohio State for the national championship. Sitting on our beds, Aaron finally asked me how he played in the All-Star game.
"You didn't look focused," I said. "You were all over the place. You better pick it up, because if you play like that at Florida, you're not going to be playing much."
The next morning, we, along with our mother, drove to Walmart and filled a few carts with items Aaron would need in his dorm room. Our mother was trying to do anything to connect with Aaron, but he remained distant. I couldn't wait to get away from the arguing and resume my life at UConn. Chapter 11. June 2007. I gave Aaron space, allowing him to settle into his new environment in Gainesville. After a few weeks, I called him to see how he was adapting to college life.
"How's everything going?" I asked.
"It's good," he said. He talked about the weather and how much he enjoyed the cool breeze at night. He spoke about how much he was studying his playbook and the amount of film he was watching. He thought he would have a good chance of playing as a true freshman. At the end of Aaron's first semester of college, we both returned home for his high school graduation. When I pulled into our driveway, I found Aaron in our backyard with a few of his high school friends. Aaron was still angry with her mom, but he met some of his old buddies at our backyard pool. He spoke with a thick southern accent, thicker than some of my teammates, who were from Georgia and Florida. I thought Aaron was messing with me, but he carried on like it was his normal way of speaking. His drawl was so heavy that at times I couldn't understand him.
"You know you grew up in Connecticut, right?" I finally said.
I pointed down to his new 860 Connecticut tattoo on his right shin to remind him. Was this Aaron trying to fit in at Florida? One afternoon, the two of us worked out together and then went to our mother's house to hang out by the pool. Neither of us was staying there. I was at my girlfriend's house and Aaron was at Tanya's, but it was good to be back home. Our mom was at work and Aaron's friends weren't in sight, so it was just the two of us, which meant Aaron didn't have to try so hard to fit in. He could be himself. He dropped the accent. He sounded thrilled about Florida and everyone there. He loved his teammates and told me that he often texted his coaches late at night when he was working out or running up and down the stadium steps. "I will be the greatest and I will not let you down," he'd tell them. Then he told me about a girl he was spending time with. He had met Alyssa in a class, and he said that she had a wonderful, caring heart. I was surprised, because growing up he rarely talked about girls he was interested in. I knew he dated a girl named Cheyenne in high school, but they separated shortly after he moved to Florida because of the distance. Aaron said Alyssa made him laugh. As we sat on the edge of the pool with our feet in the water, Aaron said, "I'll give her a call right now and put her on speaker. She's hilarious." He was right. She was funny and quick with comebacks. He seemed really happy. He was very closed off, but the more he was around, he just became himself, Alyssa told me later. "Aaron got this random idea to get a dog," she said. He couldn't have a dog in his dorm, so he made a deal with one of Alyssa's roommates to keep the dog at their place, but he had to take care of it. He would go to practice and then bring us food for dinner, and we would watch a movie. We became best friends. One day I came home, and he was moving all of his stuff in. Alyssa's roommates liked to smoke marijuana, and Aaron would join them. Alyssa told him, "I don't think you're supposed to be smoking." And he said, "Whatever, I do it all the time." He was very insecure about his schoolwork, she said. He used to brag about being an honor student in high school, and then when it came to writing his papers, he'd say, "Oh, I got a tutor for that." She encouraged him to write his next paper without help, which he took as a challenge, so he did it. "I thought it was very well written," she said. He had taken the time to put the effort into it. Aaron was so proud of it. Then one of her roommates got a hold of it. She kind of mocked him. I could see on Aaron's face how much it hurt him, like, "This is why I don't try." "He didn't like to be in vulnerable positions," she said. "He didn't show that side of himself. Even though he came off as confident, he didn't really like people to know him." Aaron often used her computer. One night, she came home late and discovered the internet search history had been deleted. She thought that was strange because she didn't believe Aaron had anything to hide. She asked Aaron why he erased what he had been looking at. "I don't want you to see the porn," Aaron joked. Alyssa figured out how to undo what he had deleted. "I saw that he was looking at a gay porn site," she said. "It hurt me at the time because I was absolutely in love with him, but at first I didn't question him about it because I thought it wasn't my place." Then, one afternoon, she gave Aaron a ride to practice, and she mentioned it. Aaron said that he had been forwarded a site from another football player, but he never watched it. "I didn't question him again because I didn't want to believe that he watched it, and I didn't want to go there," she said. One evening, Aaron left his phone in the living room after going to bed. When his phone rang, she looked at it. She and Aaron often went through each other's phones. Aaron didn't have a lock on his, and she began scrolling through his text messages. "It was a conversation with a male," she told me. "I started reading through it. They were talking about meeting up, and it was a little bit sexual," she said. The next day, she asked him about it. He just took the phone and locked it, and never brought it up again. "There were times where I felt he almost opened up to me about what was going on with him, because he trusted me, but he didn't want to hurt me. It sucked because I loved him." Aaron said he wanted to get Alyssa pregnant. "I laughed at him like he was crazy," she said. "He really wanted a family." "One of the reasons I want to be with you," he told her, "is because you're somebody who keeps me out of trouble. I'm afraid that when I make it and when I get a lot of money, I won't know what to do," he said. "What do you mean?" she asked. "You don't know and see that side of me," he said. "I love drugs too much." "Aaron," she said, "you are going to have a decision to make.
Drugs are going to be there, but I am not going to be someone who keeps you off of that. You are going to have to want that.
My cousin arranged a graduation party for Aaron at a family member's house, but Aaron refused to invite our mother. After the party was over, he drove to our mother's house to ask her to deposit the checks he'd received as gifts.
"Are you kidding me?" my mom told Aaron. "You didn't invite me to your graduation party, and you expect me to help you? No way."
Aaron kicked the side of our mother's car. She called the police, and then quickly hung up. When an officer phoned back, my mother and Aaron had both cooled down, and she told the officer that she was in an argument with her son, but they would handle it. The police never came. A few days later, I caught Aaron smoking marijuana with some of his old friends.
"Aaron, you can't smoke weed and be a college football player," I told him. "You get drug tested. These guys you're with have nothing to lose."
"I pick and choose my own friends," Aaron said.
He carried on the conversation as if there were nothing wrong with what he was doing.
Chapter 12. Fall, 2007. Game days were special. In the morning, before we left for the stadium, I'd watch ESPN in my hotel room. I couldn't wait to hear about Florida. I'd call Aaron and he'd be in his hotel room doing the same thing. He would joke with me that UConn would never get mentioned on ESPN, and that some of his teammates didn't even know UConn had a football team. Then, late in the 2007 season, our team jumped Florida in the rankings. We were number 16, and the Gators fell to number 18. I pointed this out to Aaron one November morning.
"Holy cow, Dee, you guys are really ranked higher than us," he said. "What conference do you play in again?"
We both cracked up laughing. We both knew the Southeastern Conference schedule was tougher than ours in the Big East.
"Good luck. I love you," I'd say at the end of our conversation.
He'd say it back, and we'd make arrangements to speak again that night. As a freshman, Aaron played in all 13 games. He had 9 receptions for 151 yards and scored 2 touchdowns. Shortly after the season ended, Aaron called me.
"D, I want to transfer," he said.
"What's the reason, Aaron?" I asked.
"I want to go to UConn," he said.
"Aaron, you played as a freshman at Florida," I said. "Why would you want to transfer?"
"I just want to come home," he said.
"Why?" I asked.
"I'm not getting the ball," he said.
Shortly after our conversation, he went to Coach Meyer's office and told him he wanted to transfer. Coach Meyer explained to Aaron that his future in Gainesville was bright and that he would receive more playing time the following fall. But Aaron was adamant. He wanted out of Florida. After several hours in Coach Meyer's office, Aaron called me.
"Coach Meyer said I was an amazing player," Aaron said. "He told me I did a great job as a freshman and that I was a great team player."
"Aaron, that's good," I said. "What did you say?"
"I said I didn't come to Florida to be a team player," Aaron said. "I told him I could be a team player anywhere in the country. I came to Florida to get the ball."
Aaron told me that several assistant coaches had also talked to him, telling him that it was in his best interest to remain in Gainesville. 2 days later, Aaron called me again.
"Dee, I'm going to stay."
"In all honesty, I think this is the smartest decision," I said. "You guys are stacked. You will have a good chance to play for the national championship next season." For a sixth time, Aaron had changed his mind. He was going to remain a Gator.
Chapter 13. Summer, 2008. In the summer of 2008, I flew down south to spend time with Aaron and work out with the team. It was my first time on campus since moving my brother into his dorm 18 months earlier. Aaron couldn't wait to introduce me to the players and his coaches and give me a tour of the campus and the football facilities. The first place he brought me was to the stadium. I'd never seen a structure so massive. He told me to touch the grass,
I laughed and bent down and felt the short-cut grass, just like he had when he first visited. He was right. It felt like carpet. For the workout, we ran gassers. We sprinted across the field and back several times, as their strength coach exhorted everyone to pick up the pace. I struggled to keep up with the speed of the Florida athletes. Afterward, Aaron and I walked to the practice field to continue working with backup quarterback Cam Newton and cornerback Joe Hayden, both future NFL first-round draft picks. First, Aaron and Joe raced 40 yards. They tied. Then, I challenged Aaron to a race. As we neared the finish line, he looked back at me with his smile. He beat me by 2 yards and made it look easy as I strained to keep up. Then I caught a few passes from Cam while Joe covered me. Aaron watched from the side and then did a few reps against Joe. I'd never seen such raw talent. Once we finished, we walked outside the stadium to where Aaron and his teammates had parked their scooters.
"Okay, hold on tight," he said. "There are a lot of sand patches around, and if we hit one, we could go down."
He said he had fallen a few times. That was enough for me not to want to hop on.
"Dee, I'm joking," he said. "Get on, stop being a baby. I will drive slow."
Never topping 15 miles per hour, we motored to his dorm. I was terrified, wrapping my arms around his waist. He introduced me to his suite mate, Riley Cooper, a wide receiver on the team. We walked through their joint bathroom and back to Aaron's room. Aaron had his car's bedding set, the same one my mother bought for him at Walmart the day we moved him in. He was so thrilled to have Carr's blankets and sheets. It reminded me that Aaron, deep inside, was still a little kid.
"So there's only one bed?" I said.
He put his hand on top of his head and started rubbing his hair while looking around the room. I could tell it hadn't dawned on him to figure out sleeping arrangements.
"You could sleep here, Dee," he said, pointing to the floor.
He then sprawled down on it.
"Dee, it's comfortable down here," he said, smiling. "And it's nice and cool. It's hot here in Florida. Remember, heat rises, so now you don't have to worry about getting hot at night."
I couldn't help but laugh.
"Oh, wait," he said, and then ran into the bathroom.
I thought he was going to ask Riley for an air mattress, but Aaron came back with several clean white towels.
"You can put these down on the floor as your mattress," he said.
He left again, and then returned like he had saved the day. In his hands, he now had a bigger towel.
"Dee, you can use this as your blanket," he said.
That night, underneath the long white towel, and looking at my uncovered toes below, I shivered in the air conditioning. I didn't care. I was just happy to be with my brother again. The next day, Aaron gave me a tour of the football facility. We chatted for a few minutes with Tim Tebow, who was watching game tape in the film room, and Aaron introduced me to his position coach, John Hevesy, who had us stand side by side because he thought we looked like twins. We then met the graduate assistants on staff. I wanted to pursue coaching, and the GAs were generous enough to answer my questions. As we were talking, Coach Urban Meyer stepped out of his office. Coach Meyer told us to take a seat in his office. From behind his desk, he spoke with a bluntness that caught me by surprise. "Aaron will either be the best tight end to ever play this game, or I fear he will spend the rest of his life in prison," he said. "I'm worried about the people he hangs out with outside of the program. DJ, I know you want to become a coach. After you are done playing, why don't you come down here and we'll try to find something for you so you can look after Aaron?" I told Coach Meyer that Aaron and I would talk about it, but I couldn't uproot my life and move to Florida to be a babysitter. I thanked Coach Meyer for his honesty before leaving his office. Once we were outside, I said, "What the fuck is going on, Aaron? You need to straighten up. Are you an idiot?"
"Nothing is wrong, Dee," Aaron said. "You don't understand."
For the rest of my stay, Aaron became more distant. But I still tried to connect with him. "What happened at the bar last year?" I asked. I knew our mom had to hire a lawyer for him after a fight.